The purpose of this interview is pretty simple, just to create some amazing value for entrepreneurs and wannabe entrepreneurs out there who want to achieve more success like we have. Not only have you built a multi-million dollar company working from home, but I've also been able to build a million dollar passive income business working from home while simultaneously contributing to the success of your business. And today I want to share some very exciting news. If all goes as planned, this Monday I'll be closing a multi-six-figure all-cash offer to sell the business that you and I originally created together with my wife, Fiery Wedding Planner, and we started about 5 years ago, but as your business skyrocketed, you so graciously gifted the business back to me and my wife, and I just wanted to share that great news with you that, you know, I guess if you know, if you look at it, I guess I'm your original success story because you've had a huge impact on my life personally and in business. You've really been my greatest mentor, and I don't think I would have achieved this without you, so I just wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart as we start this interview.
Well, thank you for surprising me and saying this to me on camera. Congratulations for getting an offer, and I hope it goes well.
Thank you. You know, based on your experience in business, you know, what is the most important personal skills required to become successful, you know, and wealthy? Is it communication skills, writing skills, marketing skills, you know, or is it just a will and a way?
There are five of them, I think, that are the core skills that if you want to increase your success every day, every week, every month, every year, you want to just continually improve and increase your success and make yourself more valuable and get yourself to the point where you could be dropped out of a plane, you know, with a suit of clothes in any city and immediately start making money. They go like this. Number one is your language. All right. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we're seeing that more and more people are illiterate, you know, and we're just not paying attention to how important it is to learn your language. Mm-hmm. And our language, the English language, the one we're using right now, is a very subtle language, and it's a very powerful language. And the more you learn your language, the better you become at using it to persuade and connect with people. So you got to learn your language. And I think it's important to study the history of your language, study etymology, where words come from. When you hear a word you don't know, you know, I write words down if I hear something I don't know or a word I'd like to learn or something new is coming up. And then I go learn about it and study it and see where it came from. And I try to incorporate it into my vocabulary. And that's not so that you can have a huge vocabulary that makes you sound important. It's just so that you can think better and connect with other people better. Mm. The second thing is communication. Now, language is part of communication, but there's a much bigger piece of communication than language, which is the nonverbal communication that happens between people. Most persuasion, most bonding, most connection happens on channels other than the words, right? So you've heard the old estimates that, you know, over 90% of your communication is your voice tone and your body language. Communication is so important. And what's amazing is most people are just unconscious. They're not paying any attention to it. They're not learning how to communicate with and connect with other people better. So learn about body language. Learn about nonverbal communication. Learn about how to connect with people and build rapport. The third thing is marketing. Marketing is everything from advertising to writing compelling sales letters to doing PR and all this other stuff that we've talked about. But you want to study and learn marketing because marketing is really the art of selling long distance, you know, sending a letter to someone's house instead of sending yourself, right? And what you learn when you learn marketing, and I recommend that people start with direct response marketing, you learn that you need to communicate your entire message. And you learn that the person who's hearing the message doesn't know you. They don't care about you. They're busy doing their own thing. And you only get one shot. And you need to communicate your entire message. You need to tell your whole story. And the better you get at communicating the whole story, telling your story, telling how you did something, how you came about it, how you learned all the lessons, all the benefits, all the stuff you discovered, the process of putting this information or this product or this service together, the more people become interested and the more they buy in with their hearts and the more they want to become part of the dream and become part of you in a way. So marketing, you've got to learn marketing. The fourth thing is sales. And this is the one where everyone goes, I don't want to be a salesperson. Right. One of the things that we do in our business is we take experts and we teach them how to package their information up into products like ebooks and other information products and sell them. Well, when I start talking to these experts, almost universally, they say things like, I've got all the content. I just need to find someone who can market and sell it for me. And when I say to them, well, you know what would probably be good for you is to actually learn some marketing and sales, they go, oh, I don't want to learn. I'm not a salesman. They kind of like look down at salespeople mm-hmm. like it's some like lower form of human business scum or something like that. And, you know, it's, you imagine, oh, okay, I have to put on a funky, like a weird suit and like a windbreaker, like a car salesman in order to sell my product. I would never want to do that. Well, when you really learn sales, as I know you know, because you're a fantastic salesperson, that the best selling methods are consultative selling, mm-hmm. where you don't sit down and try to talk someone into buying. You sit down and you say, let me ask you some questions. Let me learn about you and find out what all your problems are. And let me see if what I have is even a fit. And then once you've found out where they're at, what their problems are, what all the challenges they're facing are and what they'd like to accomplish, then you sell solutions. You sell them fixing their problems. You sell them getting what they want, not your thing. And the best of the best of the best salespeople are the ones that walk in and sit down and ask a bunch of questions and then say, my product can't help you. Let me refer you to someone who can, because those are the people that win the trust, and that when they say, this is the thing that will solve your problem, the prospect says, that's the thing I need, because they're trustworthy. So learning consultative selling and really learning how to sell like a professional is very important. And then the final thing is public speaking. And that's the one where people really cringe, because public speaking triggers a fear inside of humans that's literally worse than death. We fear public speaking worse than death on average. And I've asked myself why that is for years. And I don't know if this is the reason, but this is what I've come up with. They've discovered that rejection by another human being triggers a part of the brain. It triggers a pain center that's the same pain center that physical pain triggers. So rejection by a person actually hurts the way physical pain hurts, like getting cut by a knife or poked by a pin. And we can all kind of identify with that. Like at a gut level, you can go, oh, yeah, wow, that does kind of feel that way. So what does public speaking represent? The idea of potentially getting in front of 100 or 1,000 people who will all reject you. So imagine having 100 knives stabbed into your body. It's like, you know, sticking a cattle prod into the pain center of the brain. So I think that, like, evolutionarily speaking, if you get rejected by the group, you could die. Like, there's some part of us that knows that we got to hang with the group, or else we're going to be out on our own, and who knows what's going to get us out in the wild. So we don't want to be rejected. So when it comes to public speaking, all of our fears come up. We have to face, you know, like our death. It's like that moment of destiny in life. Can I do it? Well, the good news is you can learn it. And you can learn it for nothing or for very little by finding a local networking group or a Toastmasters group and getting up once a week and going there and sitting around a table with some people and standing up and doing your little 3-minute talk and then doing it again and doing it again. And the first time you do it, you'll be nervous. And the third time you do it, you'll be nervous. And the 10th time you do it, you'll go, hey, wait a minute. And then you'll start reading a little book about doing better public speaking and presentations, and you'll start incorporating it. Maybe you'll get a little coaching, and then maybe you'll volunteer to, you know, speak at a, you know, local group, or you'll put up some flyers and do some free seminars. I've done all of these exact things. And you'll invite a bunch of business people together and say, I'm going to do a networking group, and I'm going to have 10 people over, and we're just going to have some little hors d'oeuvres. I'm going to, you know, go to Subway and buy $25 worth of sandwiches, and I'm going to do a 15-minute presentation and teach you something I've learned about business. Whatever you have to do, develop and enhance and increase your public speaking skills. And if you can learn those 5 skills and then develop them a little bit more over time, they will set you free. They'll make you so you will always have something to do. You'll always be in demand. You'll always be able to create value. And I don't think it's any coincidence that you are an expert at all 5 things and that you're very successful. And they're things that you develop continually over time. And if, you know, we look around at all the people that we know in common that are really, really successful, those 5 things.
That's true. Yeah. You know, how do you define success, and, you know, what does wealth, you know, or success mean to you? Maybe it goes beyond just money. Interested in your thoughts.
Well, another thing that's happening right now that's, I think it's beautiful and amazing, is there's a shift in what you might call consciousness that's happening. And it's neat. It's really neat to see, and it's heartening, because successful people, people that are successful materially, like the old definition of success, over the last several decades have been waking up and saying, there's got to be more than this, because they're getting the money and they're getting the power and, you know, whatever, the trappings of success, but it doesn't bring them any more internal fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And so this entire, it's like a new mindset. It's a new development. It's a new culture. It's a new set of strategies and approaches, and it's a new evolutionary level for kind of the consciousness of our world, is to pursue inner success and inner fulfillment. And some of the realizations that we're starting to have, I think, as humans, is that, you know, number one, it's more fulfilling to help another person become successful than it is to get some money or some success for yourself. That in the fulfillment category, right, maybe in the short term you get some money and, yeah, you go buy a new car, or you buy a new suit, or you buy a new house and you go, yeah, I'm cool. But after a little while, the thrill of that wears off. You help someone else become successful, and then they go out and create success for themselves and others. That's the thing that creates long-term fulfillment.
I agree, 100%.
And our mutual friend, John Reese, says something that I think is profound. He says, rich is a state of mind. And that if you're rich on the inside, you can then go create money. Mm-hmm. But if you're not rich on the inside, if you don't have a rich state of mind, not only will you not be able to attract and create money, but if you do get some, you'll find a way to get rid of it. Right. Mm-hmm. A way that I have of saying it is that there's a big difference between money and wealth. And wealth comes from having knowledge, systems, assets, understanding of how to create value for others, and having systems and assets that create value. Whereas money is just these, you know, imaginary numbers and these worthless piece of paper that we, you know, try to pretend to have value. So success is about fulfillment, and I think fulfillment is about creating success for yourself, but then creating success for others and helping them succeed.
You know, for the past 5 years, I've been sort of sitting in my home office in my room making money, but, you know, not really, in my opinion, you know, doing things, you know, completely meaningful things or fulfilling things with my, you know, my time. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if I just sit in my office and make millions of dollars the rest of my life, you know, that won't be enough fulfillment for me. That I want to do more. I want to impact people's lives, help other people become successful. That's why I'm doing, you know, doing this interview and doing what I'm doing, is that I want to communicate to more people that it is possible to transform your life financially as well as emotionally. And the internet's a great way to help you do that.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. In our desire to become free as entrepreneurs, I think a lot of times we make some common, predictable mistakes that wind up creating the opposite of freedom. So we get trapped. And then the other thing that we do a lot of times without even realizing it is we try to take freedom away from other people to give ourselves more freedom, mm-hmm. rather than trying to bring and contribute more freedom to other people so that they'll contribute more to us.
Which is one of your unique abilities, and we'll definitely get into when we start talking about altitude. One of the things that fascinates me about successful people is, you know, where they came from and how they got to where they are. I think mm-hmm. a lot of people are interested in, you know, who aren't successful yet, and how do I get there, and maybe you're a model. You know, a lot of people think, well, you need an Ivy League education, or you need, you have silver spoon, you need some family money or something. So I'm really curious, you know, to hear about your background, your childhood. You know, were there early clues that you were going to be successful? Were you voted to be most successful in school or, you know, that kind of stuff?
I'm the only person I know that achieved the incredibly high achievement of being held back in kindergarten. So I got to go to kindergarten twice. I lived in trailers growing up. In fact, my first home of my own was a trailer. And interestingly enough, I was more excited about getting that place than probably any of the nice places I've lived since. Hmm. So I come from a humble beginning. You know, I'm a self-made person. I quit high school. I quit college. I went and got a high school equivalency and went to college a couple of years and quit college to go on tour with a rock band. I'm not supposed to be here right now. I don't know what happened.
You know, were you a good student in school, or was it, you know, were you just a, you know, I know that you're fascinated. You're a great learner. You love to learn and read. You know, what do you attribute it to?
I was a pretty average student. I mean, I think I mostly got B's, you know, in high school and maybe in college, you know, maybe a couple A's and a couple C's. The thing that did it for me, if I had to just like boil it down, was realizing that to achieve any significant success in life, I would need to learn about people. And when I started learning about people, I realized that, number one, they were so far from logical that it was astounding. In fact, so many things that people do are like fly in the face of logic. But once you understand why these things are happening, then all of a sudden it makes sense. It's like my buddy Dean Jackson and I talk about having a pair of 3D glasses that you can put on, and then all of a sudden a particular thing makes sense. So as I started studying people more and how they work, that's when it all started to become clear. And what I realized is that if I wanted to have success, I was going to need to help other people have success, whatever that meant to them. Mm-hmm. And as an example, my biggest accomplishment and the biggest challenge I've ever faced has been growing the team that works inside of our company, which now is over 80 people, and learning about how to fit them together in ways where we maximize their individual fulfillment and their individual contribution, so everyone is able to work on things they enjoy and contribute and take part and have an impact on the system to the highest degree possible. You know, we don't live in an ideal world. While at the same time having a system that creates value for other people, products, services, delivers value to them so that we can make money and make a profit. So studying people, group dynamics, and how they work, that's what led me to all these things that make me sound like I'm an intelligent person, when the reality is I learned almost every piece of it from someone else. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
So speaking of which, what kind of early jobs did you have, and what kind of who are your early mentors that helped you sort of evolve?
That's a good one. My first job was working for a fantastic gem of a human being. His name is Rex. And I went to work with him when I was about 15. And I worked with him for about 7 years on and off. And Rex was a coppersmith, still is a coppersmith, one of the only coppersmiths left in the country. And the work that I did was mostly manual labor, and not necessarily easy manual labor. You know, a lot of work with hammers and metal and machines, and, you know, I've got scars on my body to, you know, prove that I was there, and a lot of work in a very hot or a very cold environment and that kind of thing. There was a little bit of danger involved. And what I learned from him was that you could come to work every day, work hard, and do something that wasn't always necessarily that fun. Some parts of the job were fun and some weren't, but that you could get a certain fulfillment from having the integrity of showing up and creating value. And one time I went to Rex, maybe 3 or 4 years after I started working for him, I'm guessing somewhere around that time, and I said, you know, Rex, I've been thinking about starting a business, and I was going to start a jewelry business or something like that. And I said, I've heard that you can get these grants from the government where they'll, you know, you apply for this grant and they'll give you some money. And Rex turned to me and he said, yeah, I said, you know, you could do that if you wanted. And I wasn't disapproving, but he said, I've never taken money from anyone. I've never taken any money from the government because I really feel much better when I earn the money that I spend. And when he said it, at first I kind of shook my head and I was like, why wouldn't you want some free money? You know, why wouldn't you take advantage of anything you can get for free? But I reflected on it, and I never did apply for, you know, that grant from the government, and I took it to heart, and only now when I look back on it do I realize the incredible wisdom and the seed that he planted in my mind, which has to do with creating value, working consistently, training myself to be able to deliver consistent value in a work situation, and earning everything that I spend, not trying to get anything for free. So that's one. The second experience that was a mentoring experience even though I didn't have a specific mentor during the experience, I had a group of them, was when I went on tour with that rock band that I mentioned earlier. And it's just coincidental timing, but I went on tour with that band over 18 years ago, something like that, 18 years ago, when I was 18 years old. Right now I'm almost 37. And we just had a reunion teleconference call with the guys that I was on tour with in that band last week. We haven't all talked in, you know, almost 20 years now. And we were telling stories and so forth. And the reason why that was an important experience in my life and why it was an important mentoring experience to me was it was a bunch of young guys on tour in a truck traveling around the country playing in all of these different places. We played in schools mostly. And we had to figure things out for ourselves. So if you're out on the road and you're in a snowstorm and the truck breaks down, you can't call mommy when you're in the middle of Michigan, okay? You've got to figure out what you're doing. You've got to figure out where to get a rental car and figure out where you're going to stay and figure out how to get the truck towed in. And you realize there really is no free lunch and you've got to figure it out. And the phrase that we all used back then that came from kind of the group that put this band together was make it happen. And when I first heard it, everybody would say it, and it sounded like just a cute phrase, make it happen, make it happen. But the more we ran into complex challenges, we would just look at each other and say, make it happen. And we would accomplish things that were spectacular. It was almost like we realized we could create miracles just by knowing that we could make it happen. You can pull into any city anywhere in the country, no matter how big or small, and there's just about anything you need there if you are determined, persistent, know where to look. You can pull into a middle school, and there's like a city running in there. And anything you need, if you have the right attitude, and you're showing up humbly, and you're earnest in your approach, you can get people to do whatever you need them to do if you really need, some help. And I did things like negotiate with hotels to give us group rates. And I mean, here I am, some long-haired 18-year-old guy on the phone, trying to talk people into giving us these things and, give us discounts on getting our, equipment fixed and stuff because we're this band out on tour and all kinds of things. So that group mentored me a lot. And in fact, that was the most significant, probably single decision that I made in my life was to do that, to just strike out and to go on this adventure. The next one was a mentor named Jerry, and his name was Jerry Ballinger. He was probably the most influential person in my life, and he was the guy that knew the most about psychology, motivation, behavior, marketing that I had ever met. And he's the one that really helped me to integrate it all together, to mature myself, and to help people deliver their own gifts, to use convincing, influential marketing techniques to talk people into doing what's in their own best interest anyway. Because a lot of times, even if you've got a great thing that someone should invest in, they won't because you don't know how to explain it in the right way. Mm-hmm. So he taught me a lot of those kind of things. He taught me a lot about integrity and character and contribution and so forth. Those are three that come to mind.
Amazing. One of the things that you modeled for me was you talked about people being afraid to fail. And, most people are risk averse. Nobody wants to fail. Yeah. But you taught me to fail as fast as you can and learn from your mistakes, quickly and as cheaply as you can. Mm-hmm. I really feel, you seemed fearless to me. In business, I've seen you just say, hey, I'll throw money at anything to learn something. Mm-hmm. And modeling that for me enabled me to become more that way as well. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you decided to go from being in a band and doing that things to starting your own business. Like, how did you start your own business and how did you fund it and how did you get over that fear?
I don't know if you actually know this, but I have tried to start many businesses that never went anywhere. So I'm an expert at throwing money at things that don't work. I'm one of the best that there is at that. Failure is an idea that humans created. It's a word. It's a concept. It's an idea. And sometimes I use the word, but I don't think of it the way most people think of it. All right? So if I use the word failure, I say, well, you want to fail as many times as you can because you'll get lessons and you'll learn from them. But that's not a new idea. There are a lot of kind of self-help and personal development teachers that teach that same kind of thing. But I learned a great lesson over the years, which was if you fail, quote unquote, and then you stop, that failure, it kind of sinks into you. It affects your attitude. It affects your optimism. And you just kind of, you get what they call learned helplessness, where you just think, it's not even worth trying because I'm just going to fail again. And I don't know if I can take it. You know, I don't know if I can deal with it. On the other hand, if when you fail, you say, what did I just learn? And you keep working on it until you get one of those gut level ahas where you go, oh, I have an insight. I believe that a gut level aha insight is worth any price as long as it doesn't take you out, doesn't kill you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you hear the old saying, right? What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, anything that you can get that, oh, I get it, it's a priceless lesson. It's worth whatever it costs. So when I realized that and I started looking for the lessons, I realized that I was getting all of this stuff that was a bargain, and that in retrospect, I and essentially every person that I've ever talked to who's had spectacular failures and blown lots of money on things and time, when you really get down to it, they say, it was a cheap lesson. And I'm glad I learned it then, because if I hadn't learned it then, I would have learned it later and it would have cost me 10 times as much.
Yep.
Whereas the people that don't accomplish anything in life, they typically, when they fail, they look back and they say, yeah, I failed. I don't even want to try again because I don't want to risk anything, whatever. And they don't look for the lesson. They don't even see the lesson. So that's my philosophy.
Yeah, and you infuse that into your business. I mean, you teach that to all your staff. And in fact, some of the stuff that I do is sort of modeled on that. Some of the passive income things that I do with affiliate marketing are based on I've got a very low downside. I can fail. I fail all the time. I fail 8 out of 10 times, but I fail. It costs me very little to fail.
Mm.
It's a test. I go, and if I lose $200 or $500 or $50, big deal, because when I find a success, one of those successes all of a sudden starts making $5,000-$10,000 a month. It pays for all the $8,000 or $9,000 $200 failures and then some. So I want to just get past those failures and move on to the successes. And
well, you brought up a great point too, which is the idea of bringing light to failures, right? And you mentioned that in our business, we try to encourage people, as soon as you see something that goes wrong or you screw something up, raise your hand and say, hey, I screwed up, or I see something that's wrong over here, and make it a win. And I just want to just slip this in there.
Yeah.
The reason why that's so important is that we humans don't like to look bad in front of others. We don't like to look like idiots. We don't like to screw things up. So what we do in a business or a corporate environment is we screw something up, and then we take it and we hide it and we isolate. We try to not let anyone see it, and we try to go to work fixing it. Unfortunately, if you've screwed something up, it probably means that you didn't know how to do it right the first time. And it probably also means further that if you take it and isolate and try to fix it, you're probably going to even make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
And if you let people have that mentality of you're going to get in trouble if you screw something up, they're going to isolate, they're going to go try to fix it, they're going to make it worse. And then when they show up and it gets discovered, they might try to use a scapegoat and say, it wasn't my fault or someone else did it. And, you know, it's just a really bad situation. So if you can make an environment or culture where finding screw-ups, raising your hand when something goes wrong, saying, I made a mistake, is a win, and the person to spot the screw up the fastest is the biggest winner, then I think you can move forward very quickly. And you can, as W. Edwards Deming said, you can drive out fear, which is one of the most important things you can do in an organization.
And you've done that in the business, and I think it's an amazing, I've never seen it in any other environment, but people really do feel comfortable and are not, you know, trying to hide their mistakes.
We encourage people to screw up.
Well, you know what? I know that you're now getting ready to launch your Altitude mentoring program. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, your, you know, all, you know, what is Altitude and why are you doing it?
Yeah. Sure. It's interesting because, as you know, because, you know, you still kind of do some consulting and advising in our world and know most of the people on our team, it's actually been somewhat of a controversial thing inside of our business, because it's not exactly what we've been doing. It's a new development. And a lot of it has to do with my own personal interest in conviction and enjoyment teaching others.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, I like to teach high-performing others. Right? I like to teach the, as my mentor Jerry Ballinger used to say, the Ferrari brains. And I like working with high-performance people because they can appreciate all the time and energy that I've spent researching and trying to figure out all of the different elements of business. And when, you know, they run into a challenge, there's usually another metaphor Jerry used to use is when you've got a Ferrari, you can reach in with a screwdriver and make a tiny tweak to the carburetor and dramatically increase the performance. And if you've got an old 1973 Ford Pinto station wagon, you're not going to make that much of a difference in performance with the, you know, the screwdriver. So I want to give back. I want to contribute. I want to create more success for our company, of course. It's not 100% altruistic. But what I realized over time is that we have learned, developed, refined, tested, mastered many different areas of running a company. Everything from self and personal development to hiring people and building teams to creating systems to doing marketing to partnering with other companies. A lot of the things that are the most frustrating, difficult, hard to figure out elements of growing a large successful business. And it would be a crime if we didn't teach and give back. And so with that in mind, last year, it really started to become more obvious that the time was right, because I've always wanted to do this and I've always taught business in one way or another over the years. So as you know, in January of this year, we did the first Altitude program, which was closed door by invitation only, 100% like not open to the public. And it was very interesting to get interest and, you know, have it attended by most of the top kind of internet business marketing minds on the planet. And I was also very fortunate to have all of those great people, many of whom are friends of ours, yours and mine, come and experience it, give us feedback, and help us tune and tweak it to make it really great for, you know, the next iteration that's going to come out. And just to answer what Altitude is Altitude is a training program for high-performance business people, owners, founders of businesses who have started a company and who want to grow it to the $1 to $10 million range. And what we do is we teach from a model that I call the $10 million template.
Love that name.
And yeah, the $10 million template is a model with step-by-step tools and techniques for building a $1 to $10 million company. And my belief is that if you take all of the tools and techniques and methods and you execute all of them, you can build a $10 million company in 3 to 5 years. Or if you've already got a $10 million company, you can, you know, multiply the size of it. If you use some of the tools and techniques and do an okay job of implementing, I think you can build a $3 to $5 million company. And if you take just the bare minimum, you just get the basic education and you take the simplest, easiest techniques and shortcuts, I think you can you know, almost fail your way to a $1 million company.
I mean, I personally have doubled my business, doubled my revenue since attending your private screening of Altitude. In the last 6 months, I've made more money than I made the entire year last year. Just using a couple of simple concepts, I think one of the most powerful ones for me was your inevitability thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really shifted my mindset. So I don't know if I want to
talk about it a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
Inevitability thinking was an insight that I got, which was most people, when they're trying to create an outcome, they go right for the outcome itself and they try to tweak it and affect it and make it happen. And when you do that, in a lot of cases, you don't have the experience, you don't have the expertise, you don't know how to put all the puzzle pieces together. And if you're growing a business, kind of by definition, the next level is something you don't know how to do, because if you did, you'd already be there kind of thing. So you got to learn a lot of new stuff. If you try to do it yourself with what you know, it will almost always evade you. Right? On the other hand, if you set up the conditions so that the thing you want to have happen is inevitable, it happens automatically, it shifts your thinking. So creating conditions so that something will happen by itself is very different from trying to make the thing happen. Sounds like a semantics or wordplay, but the way that I've used it, I'll just give you a couple of examples. If we're facing a business challenge and we don't know how to solve it and we can't get it done, what I say is, okay, who are the smartest people that we have on our team and who are the smartest people we know outside of our team that other people know that we can bring in together and put all of their heads together on it? And if that doesn't work, I say, okay, who's in the next level? Let's go out and do some research, and maybe we need to hire some, you know, a company with some experts or some advisors or some consultants. And then we put those conditions into the mix. And eventually, if you keep stacking the conditions and adding them together and creating the conditions so that what you want to have happen happens automatically, then it will at some point. You actually make the outcome inevitable. It's a much deeper concept, as you know. But
yeah, to me, the distinction was really about the difference between setting goals and creating, making it inevitable that your goals will happen. Mm-hmm. That was, in fact, the... tell me if this resonates with you, but I think a great example is if you need to lose weight. You know, you can set a goal and say, I want to lose 50 pounds. What are your chances of doing that if you just set a goal? You can do it in terms of, like you said, solving a problem, mm-hmm. saying, okay, I need to lose weight. How do I do that? I guess I should probably, go on a diet and do some exercise. And so now you've identified what the things you need to overcome to lose the weight, but it still doesn't necessarily get you there. Mm-hmm. But saying, what do I need to do to make it inevitable that I lose weight? Okay, if I hire a personal trainer, if I get food delivered every day to my house, that's the right kind of food to eat. And I do these things, it's inevitable you're going to lose the weight.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference for me in my mindset. Applying that kind of thinking, going, hey, I want to make more money, or I want my focus, I want more free time. My business, how do I make that inevitable, is a lot different than saying, yeah, I'd really like to have some more free time this year.
I'll dig into what you just said, because like I said, there's a lot more to it. Mm-hmm. Up until now, there has been one main way of achievement, one method of accomplishment, and that has been goal setting, right? That's the one that we all know. You got to set goals, and there's all these methods for setting goals and achieving them, and it's a good, useful technique. And then a guy named Bob Beal came along and wrote the book Stop Setting Goals If You'd Rather Solve Problems. And his big innovation and discovery was that 80% of people don't like setting goals. They're not motivated by goals. And in fact, when you're at the seminar and you say, okay, it's time to set some goals, yeah, 20% of the people go, yeah, because they love setting goals. But 80% of the people go, oh, this isn't very motivating. I don't really want to do this. So these other 80%, they're motivated by solving problems. Right, so 80% of people are problem solvers. And if you want to get them fired up about doing something, you have to say, we have a problem and I need some help solving it. Mm-hmm. So I think you need to flex both muscles. Actually, my mentor Jerry taught me this. You need to learn to flex both. You need to be a good goal setter and you need to be a good problem solver so that you can motivate yourself, but you also need to be able to motivate others. So you need to be able to communicate, okay, here's the goal, here are the problems. Here's the goal, here are the problems. What I realized is that that's only part of the picture, because there's not a methodology that's built in there, mm-hmm. right? There's not a method to getting to those things. Those lead to you going and going, well, if I want to get to the goal, what are the steps I need to do? Or if I want to solve the problem, what are the mini problems, or what are the steps I need to do to solve those problems? But it doesn't really activate the mind in a way that guarantees you're going to get there. If you ask yourself, I want to have this outcome happen. What do I have to do to make it so it's inevitable? It does something to the way that you think. It makes you set up what I call conditions, right? Setting up the conditions for success. And a perfect example, if you want to lose weight, most people aren't willing to do the things that it takes to lose the weight, mm-hmm. right? They're not willing to eat the right food, or they're not willing to do the exercise. But if you say, what would make it inevitable, then your mind goes, oh, inevitable. I'd have to maybe get an accountability partner who comes over here every day, and I tell them, if you come over and I don't go jogging with you, I'll give you $100. That would be so painful that I would have to do it. Mm. And you could say, well, that's just getting an accountability partner, but that would come from using inevitability thinking as a tool. And when you use inevitability thinking, it makes you come up with solutions, combinations, and ways of accomplishing things that you wouldn't have otherwise.
So powerful. So I assume, just knowing you and the kind of value you create, that you're going to make it inevitable that anyone who attends Altitude is going to actually become more successful using the strategies and the tools that you're going to offer. Are there other things in Altitude that you want to talk about that you're, that are unique or interesting ways of thinking about or approaching business that are new or you've developed that you want to share?
Yeah, I'd love to. Mm-hmm. When we started our business, this current business, over 6 years ago, and you were basically there right from the beginning, I went out and looked around for education and training as we reached new levels to try to figure out how to do new things when you're dealing with group dynamics and different types of systems and a business is, doubling and tripling every year and you've got all these scaling issues. And I just couldn't find good training most of the time. There was no place I could go that showed you how to build a business from startup up to that multi-year $10 million level. So as I learned the different things that I needed to learn, and some of them took years or cost a lot of money to learn a simple lesson, I'm like, well, why wasn't there someone that could just have told me how to do that? I took a lot of notes, as I normally do. And then later on, as I was looking at the marketplace, I realized that there are kind of low-end trainings in a lot of cases, like an audio program or a book. And then there are maybe seminars where you can go and learn a little bit about business, maybe a little bit about hiring, or you could go to a marketing seminar and learn a little bit about marketing, or you could go to one of these kind of all-star business seminars where there are a bunch of big names, like the big authors all teaching, and you leave after spending a couple of $1,000s and a couple of days, and you're all fired up, and you look down at all the notes you took, and you think, I got four things that I can use here. I didn't really get the meat. I didn't really get something out of this that I can go execute. I don't know what to do step by step. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the high-end, you know, executive MBA programs where you go spend 2 years and you have to take 2 years out of your life, or, you know, maybe evenings and weekends in some cases, or maybe even longer, and invest for the top business schools. It's $120,000 to $150,000 for tuition. And when you get done with that, yeah, you got a good education, but you missed a lot in the meantime. It cost a tremendous amount. And I've got to say, you know, I've talked to a lot of people that have gotten MBAs who didn't get the ground level stuff that you need to know in order to grow and scale your business, right? A lot of it is theoretical. A lot of it's not practical. You don't get the hands-on stuff. So, you know, and again, those are, you know, six-figure investments. So what I wanted to do is put together a mentoring program for entrepreneurs where they could come in. It would be highly efficient. So the strategy and the theory that they would be learning would also be kind of wrapped with step-by-step techniques. They would be trained by not only me, but also the leaders that are on our team. Part of the training actually involves over 10 of the different managers and leaders that actually work inside of our business, because I also saw that there is no training program where you can learn from people that are running businesses, that are actually managing teams of people. And then also we have guest kind of faculty trainers who have grown businesses, grown $10 million or larger businesses, and also those who have specialized in their careers helping people grow these businesses. So it's a holistic approach. It's all of the best thinkers, the best teachers, the best trainers, and the people that are doing it that I can find. Several of the people are not professional. Actually, most of the people that train, they're not professional teachers. They're professional business people. Mm-hmm. And I've had to call in favors and get them to come speak and, you know, do a lot of stuff because I want to offer the most value. I want to create an environment where you are learning the techniques that you can take back and implement to hire people, to do marketing, to scale your business, to install systems. And the format of the program, would it be helpful if I just down the format and give you the key pieces? There are essentially five keys, I believe, to growing your business. The first key, and the most important, and the most overlooked, is you becoming a person who can lead the growth and the development and the progress of a multi-million dollar operation. And if you want to do that, you can't just stay who you are. You're going to have to grow and develop. And there's emotional growth that has to take place. There's psychological growth. There's logical growth. There's physical growth. You have to develop and become a different person. And one of the concepts that I've been doing a lot of work on is what I call the multitasking myth. And it's become very popular in the last 10 years, 20 years, to become known as a multitasker. Or if someone's talking to you and you're playing with your BlackBerry or you're working on email and they say, hey, are you listening to me? You're like, yeah, I can multitask. And, you know, we kind of wear it as a badge of honor. You know, I can multitask. And what has been discovered over the last several years is that multitasking actually hurts efficiency. This mindset of I'm a multitasker is taking value away from us. My friend Tim Ferriss, who wrote a great book called The 4-Hour Workweek, he wrote a great blog post on this. And the theme of the blog post was Smoking pot lowers your IQ less than multitasking. And he quotes this article that was in the paper about how they tested the IQs of people that were smoking pot and then the IQs of people who were multitasking and working on their BlackBerries and answering emails and whatever, and that there was actually a greater drop in IQ from people that were dealing with interruptions and multitasking than there was from, you know, getting high. Which is actually not really that surprising, because if you walk into most office environments right now, and you'll notice if you sit down in business meetings with people, they're just scattered. They're just not there, you know. There's another development that's happened recently, just over the last year or two, that I've heard about. This woman discovered, I believe it was a woman, and she called it, coined the term, continuous partial attention. And this phenomenon is we humans are overwhelmed, and we've got so many things to worry about, that we're now kind of carving off parts of our mind to be continuously paying attention to something, vigilant about some aspect, and we never shut off. It's just always thinking about or worrying about or paying attention to that thing. So we're even fragmenting our ability further. And if you want something to work on and develop, and unfortunately we don't have the time to get into all the details here, but instead of jumbling all your time up and mixing it all up and multitasking and, you know, trying to take a 15-minute break to rejuvenate yourself while you're still checking your BlackBerry, I think that the skill of the future as a business leader and as an individual is to develop two types of time, right? Time management is on the, you know, on everyone's minds. Stephen Covey has one of my favorite quotes. He says, "Time management is a misnomer. The challenge is to manage ourselves," right? We have to learn to manage us because time's going to go by. You can't manage it. You got to learn to manage yourself. So there, in my world, in my reality, there are two types of time, right? There are two types of the way that you are interacting with time. One is when you're engaged, and the other is when you're disengaged. One's when you're plugged in. The other is when you're unplugged. One is when you're focused in your best talent, in your strength, adding massive value, creating massive value, and you're in that state that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls flow. And the other is when you're unplugged, you're rejuvenating, you're renewing yourself. You're doing what Stephen Covey calls sharpening your saw. And the better that you can become at separating those two things and learning to do each of them better and better and to not mix them all up, the better.
Now, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
yeah, no,
you've actually done, I've watched you evolve from working crazy hours, you know, single guy at home staying up all night, to you've really done a good job of actually, over the, you know, not only building teams and creating freedom for yourself time-wise, but actually, you know, traveling and rejuvenating as well as getting really focused and working hard. Can you maybe talk a little bit how you achieved that?
Yeah, well, essentially, there are only a few things that we each get that are our talents, right? Back in, I don't even remember what year this was, but probably in the 60s, Peter Drucker wrote The Effective Executive, and he was an incredible visionary. He saw way into the future, and he said, focus on your strengths, not on your weaknesses, and focus in large blocks of uninterrupted time, not in a bunch of fragmented things, and don't work on something for a little while and then get distracted and then try to come back, because it takes you 20 or 30 minutes to just get back on track, so you're wasting all this time. And so I developed a system that I call the productivity pyramid, where you can sit and just break out your time into four levels. The bottom level is things that you're doing that have zero or negative value. Then the next level is things that have low dollar per hour value. The next level up is things that have high dollar per hour value. And then the top of the pyramid is things that have high lifetime value. And to mention Stephen Covey again, when you think about the things that have high lifetime value, you usually come to the realization that these are things that you're going to have to be very proactive about, that you're going to have to focus a lot of time on and a lot of energy on, and you're going to have to build in advance. Your physical health is a perfect example. If you wake up in the morning and you kind of feel like you don't have that much energy or you kind of feel out of shape, that's not something that's going to make you go, oh, I have to go do some exercise right now. If you want to wake up and feel really good and have energy and have health, you're going to have had to have woken up for the last year in a row every day and said, I'm going to go proactively do exercise. I'm going to go proactively eat right. Those are the kinds of things that have high lifetime value. Well, likewise, in your business, there are things that you are good at, you are uniquely good at, that have high lifetime value and some that have high dollar per hour value. And you need to discover what those things are. You need to go through a process of discovery, refining, development to find out what those things are. And then as much as you can, steal time from things that are interrupting you and wasting your time and people trying to get you to pay attention to them just, you know, for attention's sake. And just when you're plugged in, live in those strength focus areas that have high lifetime value and high dollar value. And then when you disengage, don't partially disengage and say, I'm available 24/7. Call me anytime you want, because while you're rejuvenating and while you're unplugged and while you're paying attention to the things that are growing your soul, let's just say, and making you a happier, healthier, more fulfilled person, what I'm trying to say is if you can focus on those things and be completely unplugged, you're going to be much better at the other one and vice versa. Mm. So I don't know if that sounded too convoluted, but I think you get the point.
Mm. No, I'm watching you do that in your life, and it's, I'm striving to do the same.
Yeah. So there are a lot of other pieces to that, but, you know, if I could just give you one message, it's when you're on, be totally on and just keep tuning and refining your ability to contribute and be just engaged and focused. And when you're off, be as disengaged as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. Be involved in something that rejuvenates you, hobbies, time with friends, relaxation, where you're not tuned to that other frequency where your brain isn't paying continuous partial attention.
So you were saying there were five things and you is the first thing.
Yeah, that's the first one. Okay. So the second area that we focus on in altitude is your market. And your market includes the people that you're talking to, your niche, your products and services. To be in the program, you have to have a business that's started and making at least some money. So I assume that you have a product or service that you've already created. That's a prerequisite. But what most people who are starting businesses and most businesses that are launching products and services do is they create things that sound good to them that maybe they would want to buy. You know, you see the inventors on these TV shows or your uncle who comes in and says, you know, I've just invented this, you know, this fantastic new thing. It's a radio-controlled helicopter that's also a TV antenna. And, you know, imagine how everybody's going to want one of these things, you know. Well, and, you know, it's no surprise that almost every product and service that's launched in the marketplace, nobody buys it. Nobody wants it. And so when it comes to your market, creating a product or service, going into a niche, and approaching a group of people and trying to get them to buy whatever it is, invest their hard-earned money into whatever it is you're selling, you might want to adopt this one rule that's kind of the golden rule of the market, which is look for prospects who are looking for you, right? Look for prospects who are looking for you. And the reason why this is, and it's very simple, and it's so intuitive and like, you know, duh, and common sense after you hear it. If you create something and then part of the process is you need to talk people into wanting to buy it, you're going to spend so much time and energy trying to talk them into wanting it that you're going to blow all your profit. You're not going to make any money. Whereas if you look out into the marketplace and you say, okay, here's my audience. Here's what our general expertise is in. What is something that they are looking for where they have a problem or they have a massive burning desire? They're looking for something, but there aren't any options for them. They can't find options. Now you've got a business opportunity. Mm-hmm. And if you just use that one simple formula, it'll eliminate 80 or 90% of all your ideas immediately, and it will allow you to focus on offering things that people will already want to buy.
Mm. That makes total sense. It's like the direct marketing principle that it's far easier to sell your own customers more products than it is to go out and find new customers.
Right.
It's right on what you're saying.
Yeah. Sure. And so, you know, again, there are a lot more pieces to this puzzle, and there's a, you know, a step-by-step way of doing this and analyzing your market, but look for customers who are looking for you. The third component is your marketing, which has to do with everything that would be advertising, marketing, and you might even be able to include things like merchandising and sales under this umbrella. And my approach, the thing that I think makes us in, you know, our business different, and the way that I think is that we use what I call holistic marketing. And the reason why I use that word, it sounds kind of new agey and modern, but it really means what I'm trying to say. As I studied marketing over the years, marketing happens to be the part of business that I have found most interesting in the area that I have studied the most and kind of gotten into more scientifically. At first, I used brand advertising type marketing. That's what I learned first. And I tried to get my name out there. Well, then I learned another method that was like philosophically opposed to brand advertising called direct response marketing. And when I learned direct response marketing, the philosophy was, and I love the way my buddy Dean Jackson says, he says, the objective is not to get your name out there. It's to get your prospect's name in here, right? Direct response marketing is about asking for a response, giving a direction to action with specific steps for the prospect to take so that they respond and you can convert them and connect with them and then stair-step them through a process to lead to a sale. Well, that was a revelation. And as a kind of a baby marketer, when I tried direct response marketing, it worked so much better that I just stuck with it, and I used it as my only way of marketing for quite a while, for years, in fact. Well, as I kept studying and learning and looking around, I realized, well, but there's something to these other philosophies of marketing. I mean, these guys that are doing brand advertising, some of them are multi-billion dollar companies. They can't be completely wrong. And just because philosophically they're not aligned with what I've been doing, you know, and people that are doing PR, companies are doing PR, it's not, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, in fact, some of them are getting millions of dollars worth of PR for free. And companies that are focused on, you know, the persona of their company, or companies that have a front person speaking and kind of communicating and trying to build relationships with customers, maybe these actually have some value. So I started experimenting with integrating them together and combining them. And I've eventually realized what Ken Wilber says is everyone is right. That in just about any situation, everyone's right. It's just that not everyone is right to the same degree. And our responsibility as smart business people and evolved marketers is to study these different philosophies and figure out how to combine them in the right amounts for the situation.
Absolutely. That you're in. Well, as you know, I've got a master's degree in direct marketing in a program that was called the Integrated Marketing Communications Program, where they were, it was a big buzzword in the 90s, and they were just trying to teach advertising and marketing students or grad students to go into ad agencies and be strategic generalists who could look at a situation and say, yes, you know, everyone's vying for the advertising budget, and the direct marketing team says they want some money, and the advertising team and the PR team, but that's not necessarily what's best for the client. All those things have value, but you're right, in different amounts for different situations, and having somebody who understood all of those things and could apply them in the right levels to a company's marketing goals or needs, you know, it was a critical new way of thinking about business, not just saying, you know, we need 25% of the budget to go to advertising and 25% to go here, just so each team has something to do.
Yeah. So. And I mean, truly, you know, not to blow smoke, but you are one of the smartest marketers and salespeople that I know or have ever met or heard of. And you do, whenever we're in a situation, you look at your toolkit full of marketing tools and pull out whatever is appropriate. And just as, you know, advice to anyone listening, if you're working with a marketing expert and they are prescribing their brand of marketing, so to speak, for every problem, you probably want to be aware. You want to send a little flag up and say, you know what, maybe I need to, you know, broaden my horizons a little bit. And on the other hand, if once in a while they're saying, you know, my method of marketing probably isn't best for this situation, we might want to get another expert, or you might want to try something else, then you're probably dealing with someone that is more aware and knows these different things. And the fourth component of altitude is people. And there's a fundamental truth in business that you essentially can't escape. There are very few people that have ever escaped this one, if any. And that is, if you're going to have any large success, it's going to be through the efforts of many other people. And people don't wake up in the morning and say, ah, I want to find someone to tell me what to do. Right? That's not what we do. And if you want to attract what we call stars, the best of the best, the highest quality professionals, you need to create an environment that those kinds of people want to be in. And it's not an environment that is like old school business where they come in and they're being told what to do. I've had the good fortune over the last several years to meet a bunch of very successful business people, several of them billionaires. And whenever I get a chance to meet one of these people at a conference or through an introduction or whatever, I always try to take the opportunity to ask them a question. And a lot of the questions I ask them are about people and talent and spotting talent. And I was at a conference and I got to ask Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, who's a billionaire, a question. And I said, Eric, you guys have been spectacular at attracting star talent, right? Just the best of the best people. What have you learned about attracting and retaining these people? And he said something that it was direct, it was clear, it was powerful, and it instantly rang true. And what he said is that stars, A players, the best, they work for impact, not for money. They work for impact. They want to affect things. They can get the money anywhere. They're a star. They're in demand. They want to make a difference in the world. And so if you're going to create a fast-growing business that's going to free you and run under its own power and attract star professionals, what you're going to have is an environment that lets them make a lot of decisions, lets them contribute, and lets them make an impact. And there's a formula for doing it. And then the last thing in the business is systems. And this is the area that everyone kind of goes, oh, you know, this sounds like the boring, you know, kind of work where you got to build the systems infrastructure. And because I don't want to take too much time here, and I know we're running out of time anyway, I'll just say that there are a couple of different philosophies that I've seen, main philosophies when it comes to building systems in businesses. And one philosophy, you might kind of call it the franchise philosophy, or the philosophy that Michael Gerber of eMyth fame espouses, which is design every system so that people that have the lowest possible level of skill can run them. Create standard operating procedures and manuals for every single thing in the business. And then, you know, to his credit, Michael Gerber says, now don't hire people that have the lowest possible level of skill. You know, you want to find good people, but make it so that the lowest possible level of skill can do it. And the other side is what my buddy Dean Jackson and I call the Harvard model, which is when you go to Harvard, they don't have everything organized so that people with the lowest possible level of skill, they go find the smartest, best talent in the world, and they say, you develop everything custom, right? And in a business, depending on what kind of business that you have, you may want to use more of one or more of the other. But the general rule of thumb is the more repetitive a process is, the more you want to develop a standard operating procedure and a manual and a standard way of doing it. And the more complex a process is and the less often that it happens, the more you're going to need kind of trained, talented experts who know how to deal with these kinds of situations, right? So if you're building McDonald's and or Starbucks, and you've already got 3,000 of them built, and you know how the whole thing works, you can go in and make a procedure for just about every single thing in there. And any problem that's going to come up, you've probably dealt with before, and any exceptions that happen, you can have a system for even dealing with those. So it's like, here's the book. Go to school, learn this manual, and run the thing. On the other hand, if you're building a Google and every single thing that you're doing is new and cutting edge, and you're going to build a new piece of technology that incorporates pictures from space with, you know, location mapping and directions and dynamically creating stuff, you know, at the touch of a button, well, you're probably going to want to have some of the best computer scientists in the world and the smartest talent so you can say, hey, we've got an idea. And then these people will go build this custom one-off thing that will work really well. So we have methods, of course, and systems for building standard operating procedures and manuals, and we teach all that kind of stuff. But you also have to take into account these other things, and there are ways of approaching that too. So the five components that we teach and the five things that you really need to pay attention to in your business are you, your market, your marketing, your people, and your systems. And if you can get all those things nailed down and invest some time, effort, and energy in each of those and make sure you're evolving in each of those areas as you grow and as you're doubling and tripling your business every year, you can be ahead of the curve, and I think you can build a business that sets you free and gives you more life.
I agree. I'm very excited about Altitude. Where would people find more information about Altitude if they wanted to check it out?
Very simple. Just go to getaltitude.com. GetAltitude. And by the way, on there, we're going to have a bunch of great free videos that we're going to be giving away, a lot more of the content, you know, interviews with me, other things like that, even some free software. So get out there and sign up.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, this has been incredibly enlightening, and I think it'll be very valuable to everyone who's just watched it. And I want to just thank you for taking the time to share it. I know you're going to be incredibly successful in making a big contribution to business people and entrepreneurs with your Altitude program. And that's all I have. Unless there's anything else you want to share or say.
No, thank you for organizing this and putting it together. It's been fun. You dug into my mind and got stuff out of me that I haven't thought about in a lot of cases in years.
Cool. All right, man. Well, thanks very much.
Appreciate
it.